Well, we've been talking about baptism, and we started with an understanding of what baptism really is. And we looked at what happened in the second century. And of course, that was a century that's unlike the century where we live. We don't typically expect children, babies, to die. But that was not the case in the second century. It was almost a given that many children were going to die before they ever reached their first birthday. In fact, some estimates put it as high as 30% of all children born didn't reach their first birthday. And because of that, a great concern arose about what we were going to do about these babies that were dying. We wanted to know that they had a relationship with God. And so we tried to establish that relationship with God in baptism. Now, we've talked about how baptism is for repentant believers who had sinned. These babies were not that, but nevertheless, we still worried about it. So in extreme cases, in the second century, not the first when the apostles were still around, second century, in extreme cases when children were about to die and there was no question that they would never reach an age where they could be believers, they baptized them. I understand why they did it. It was out of concern. Now, it was a misplaced concern, but it was a concern. It was in extreme cases in the second century. Remember, we read that tomb inscription that they found, a little baby that was less than a year old, was baptized, and then 7 days later died. Then we talked about the third century and how the exception to the rule started to become the rule, and how babies were routinely baptized. Well, we come to the fourth and the fifth centuries, and the situation in the culture changes. Something very important happens, and Christianity changes its, well, Christianity doesn't change its nature, but the way that people looked at Christianity changed. There are two very important things that happened in the 300s. The first was that Constantine in 313 AD issued what's called the Edict of Toleration. And Christianity went from being a persecuted group to being a group that was legally recognized. They weren't persecuted anymore. In fact, the Edict of Constantine did something very specific as regards the property that had been owned by churches, and it was returned to them. Now, what that tells me is that it had been confiscated, and then it was later returned when Christianity became a legal religion. We're familiar with the persecutions of the Christians in the first century that extended into the second and the third centuries. In 391, almost 100 years later, Theodotus declared Christianity to be the only legal religion. Now that's important. It went from being a legal religion to being the only legal religion. And the effect of moving like that was very similar to the effect that you saw when we talked about the American colonies and people that were coming from England or Ireland or Scotland or Germany, and they were settling the American colonies. In most of the American colonies, there was only one official religion. And what that meant was, if you weren't a part of that official religion, you couldn't vote, you couldn't hold property, you couldn't run for office. That's what happened in the 391, in that edict that Theodotus placed in the Roman Empire. Christianity becomes the only legal religion. And with it came certain benefits. By this time, you couldn't be a Roman citizen unless you were a Christian. And so the thought process behind infant baptism accelerates so that we can now make them a part, not of a relationship with God, but we can make them a part of a relationship with the government. Now, this is important because it accelerates leaving God's plan as far as baptism was concerned. Baptism was never designed to make you a part of any earthly kingdom. But it did that. That's what happened in 391. And I suggest that that's a cautionary tale for us. We don't ever want to see an official religion in our country. Christianity is not American democracy. Christianity doesn't have anything to do with physical government. I can serve God no matter what the government is where I particularly choose to live. Now, I may be persecuted. I may have favored status. I may be free to practice my religion, as is the case, I think, in our country. But nevertheless, in those countries where you cannot be a Christian, those people can still worship God. Now, they suffer greatly, but I want you to understand how very dangerous it is when Christianity is married to government. And we don't want to see that in our nation. Now, because infant baptism made you a citizen, there is this new reason for infant baptism. You see why? Originally, it was designed to give you a relationship with God because we were worried that you might die before you had a chance to express a belief in God. And so we baptized you even as a baby. Now, we're baptizing you as a baby so that you are a citizen. Remember, this is a big deal. Remember the discussion that the Apostle Paul had with the Roman centurion that was guarding him? The centurion said, I am a Roman citizen. I paid for this with a great deal of money. This is dear to me. And Paul said, I'm a Roman citizen because I was born a Roman citizen. Well, that's the way baptism begins to be viewed after 391. You would think that having Christianity be the only legal religion would be a good thing. But trust me, it's not. It has never been good for Christianity to be the only legal religion. Anybody have thoughts about that?
So then what would happen, say, an individual would refuse to become a Christian, but they're a natural born Roman.
Oh, they wouldn't be. Their birthright citizenship didn't mean anything. You had to be a Christian. That's like, you know, we in our country, you are a citizen if you're born here. Well, that's the way it should have worked in the Roman Empire, but it stopped working that way. Now you weren't a citizen unless you were a Christian. Serious, serious, serious change in the way that they viewed Christianity and the way that they viewed baptism. Yeah.
Christianity changed considerably because when you're using the term Christianity, it's really not like New Testament Christianity any longer. All these centuries, it has morphed and changed.
Right.
And so what they're calling Christianity really isn't like the New Testament Christianity.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
So other things have morphed as well as Baptism.
That's true. Okay. That's true. Well, we're kind of focusing on baptism at this point.
I understand.
Okay. Now, what happened was there was a council at Carthage in 419. It was led by Augustine. That's a name that you ought to be familiar with. And this council in 419 anathematized, meant denied the personhood of those who rejected infant baptism. Adamic guilt is assumed. That's where you become a sinner because you are born a human. And as a human, you participate in Adam's sin, you become a sinner. Now, we've examined that thought. That thought is not true, but that's what happened at the Council of Carthage. Now, remember, infant baptism was practiced a long time before the Council at Carthage. They're not the people who decided that now infants need to be baptized. They just acted on the Edict of Theodotus, and they took it one step further. Yeah, Bob.
At this time, then, is the church referred to as the Holy Roman Church, or what?
No, it isn't. Well, what's happened is in the 300s, Rome begins to sort of splinter. And Rome, Italy, is under attack by barbarians. So a great deal of Roman authority was moved over to Constantinople or Istanbul now. And we refer to that as the Byzantine Empire. It's really the Roman Empire that split in two, and the Byzantine side of the empire is still doing well. The Roman side of the empire is kind of falling apart. So by the time that you get to the recognition of the first pope, that's the first pope in Rome. We don't talk about the first pope that was recognized in Constantinople. That's the Eastern Orthodox Church. And we don't talk about that one very much. But they really predate the Pope declaring himself in Rome. So the church is beginning to divide, and we're kind of in the line of the Roman church. We're not in the line of the Eastern church. And when I say we're in the line, I'm talking about culturally, socially. The church is not in that line, but culturally, we owe a debt to the Roman Empire, not to the Eastern Orthodox Empire. And if you ever get a chance to meet with Eastern Orthodox folks, it's a fascinating thing to do. You ought to meet with them if you get a chance. They would be appalled that we have seats in our auditorium. The Eastern Orthodox Church that came through the line of Constantinople, they have no chairs. There's no place to sit. That's because they think it's an affront to God to actually come into the presence of the king and sit. You would not do that. If you went to see the King of England, you would not take a folding chair with you into the room so that you could sit where the King of England was. And by the same token, they would never have chairs in their auditorium. Kim and I went, used to go out to Eklutna up in Alaska. Eklutna is a native village that's in the Eastern Orthodox cultural tradition. And we went into the little church that they have there, not a chair in sight. And I talked to the Eastern Orthodox priest, and he said, yeah, that's just a Roman innovation to have chairs in their assembly. He thought it was horrible that we have chairs in our assembly. That's an aside, I guess. But the Roman church continues to assume Adamic guilt. Because of Adamic guilt, they say baptism is necessitated. That was their thought process. Okay. Yeah.
I just want to reiterate what I think I heard you say, and that was, when you're talking about the church and you're talking about the Roman church and the Orthodox, that's where all of these changes were made, but that's really not God's church, because this is all the bishops and everything else, which has all been added to, and you're just basically showing us what rabbit hole they went down, right?
Yeah, you're right. This is not the way God designed it. This is understanding the history of how we got to the place where we are today. You're absolutely right. When I say the Roman Church, I'm talking about the Roman Catholic organization. It bears little resemblance to the church that we read about in the New Testament. As does the Eastern Orthodox, bears little resemblance to the church we read about in the New Testament.
Dean, where was Christ Church during this time?
It had always existed and has always existed. It tended to be underground. When I say underground, they met in secret. Okay. And they tended to be persecuted by the Romans as a group of heretics. But I don't think there's ever been a time when the church that God designed ceased to exist. I don't think it's possible to put it out of existence. I think God kept it going. And in fact, if you go to some of the cemeteries in Europe where the people have been buried there for centuries, you know, we think it's old if it's 200 years. But if you go to Europe and you go to those cemeteries, you'll find inscriptions in those cemeteries. This person was just a Christian. So my conclusion is that the church has always existed. Alexander Campbell and Barton W. Stone didn't revive the church. It had always existed. That's the American reformers. It had always existed. They just kind of helped it come back up to the surface so people could see it. But in terms of people with a religious bent, the Roman Church in Europe begins to be the recognized church. Yeah.
Wasn't it in the 600s?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah. Years after this.
Yes. The Eastern Orthodox Church had a pope, a papa. That's what the pope is. They had a pope long before the Romans did. In fact, they thought the Romans were just crazy because they wanted to have their own. So this is the Bishop of Constantinople, Chrysostom. Now the Eastern Church, Constantinople, we're not talking about the Roman Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church, Eastern Orthodox wing, practiced infant baptism, but they did infant baptism for an entirely different reason. I found this very, very interesting. This is Chrysostom. He is the Bishop of Constantinople. He said, he wrote in a book that he prepared called Baptismal Instructions. He wrote, "You see how numerous are the gifts of baptism, although many men think the only gift it confers is the remission of sins. We have counted its honors to the number of 10. It's on this account that we baptize even infants, though they be sinless, that they may be given further gifts of, given the further gifts of sanctification, righteousness, filial adoption, inheritance, that they may be brothers and sisters of Christ and become dwelling places of the Spirit." So they expanded the notion of baptism. For the Eastern Orthodox Church, baptism was not a response to sin. So for them, it didn't matter that the baby was born sinless. Okay? Because for them, baptism is not a response to sin. It's something entirely different. Does that make sense? Now, I think in some ways, when we embark on a relationship with Christ, we do experience sanctification. We do experience righteousness. We do experience filial adoption, or we're adopted as brothers of Christ. Okay? I think they're just missing the point. But to argue with an Eastern Orthodox religious person, if you said babies are sinless, they don't need baptism, he would say, "You're right, babies are sinless. They still need baptism." You have to understand where the person you're talking to comes from before you can understand how you have to approach that person. Now, in our country, 99% of the people that you'll encounter, their knowledge of Christianity is in the Roman tradition. Okay, they may be mistaken, but their notions of Christianity are in the Roman tradition. Eastern tradition is very different. Something else happens in the fourth and fifth century. Early on, baptism was always by immersion. And then they began to, and this is typically the way things go, in extreme cases, they began to pour water on a person or sprinkle water on a person. This was Cyrus of Jerusalem in 386. This will give you an idea of how they viewed immersion relative to baptism. He said, just as one who plunges into the waters and is baptized is encompassed on all sides by the waters. So, if you're immersed, you're encompassed on all sides by the waters. And then there's a change. And it's partial immersion. This is Chrysostom. And we've talked a little bit about him. He is the bishop down in Carthage. He said, when we immerse our heads in water, the old man is buried as in a tomb below and wholly sunk forever. Then as we raise them again, the new man raises in its stead. As it is easy for us to dip and lift our heads again, so it is easy for God to bury the old man and show forth the new. So the mode of baptism begins to be modified. They would immerse the head, but not the whole body. Heard comments? Yeah.
Phyllis just said, how do you do that?
Well, it's I think in our country we call it waterboarding. that was a bad comment. I shouldn't have made it. This is a person whose head is immersed in water, but not the body. If you think of this in terms of death, burial, and resurrection, then you have the head is buried in the ground and the feet are still up in the earth. That's being a little facetious, but you see the change. And that's important. The mode of baptism changes from immersion of the whole body to partial immersion. And that sticks around for a while. That played out in the early 19th century. People worried when they were baptized if their whole body didn't go under the water at the same time. In other words, you would tip them over to bury them in the water and their foot would come up. And so they worried that they weren't baptized because their foot floated to the top of the water. So there was great care that was exerted to make sure that the whole person was immersed in water, even their hair. Now, I haven't read too much about the hair, but I do know that women frequently at that time would pin their hair back so that it didn't float to the top of the water. And when they were immersed, their whole body would be immersed.
You need to tell your Steve Woodside story.
I'm sorry?
You need to tell the Steve Woodside story.
Oh, Steve Woodside's a friend of ours. He's a little bit younger than we are. He's a body surfer in California. So he wanted to be baptized. I was going to baptize him. Got in the water. And when I tilted him back, I could hear him take a big breath. Well, he had these incredible lungs. So when he breathed in, he floated. He didn't go under the water. So you know, not knowing exactly what to do, I put my elbow in his chest and went like that real hard. And all the air came out of his lungs and he sank like a rock. And both of us almost drowned before I could figure out a way to get him to stand back up. It was a little bit comical, but not really comical. Now, in the fourth and fifth centuries, sprinkling is still an exception. And it was typically invoked when a person was on their deathbed and you couldn't immerse them in water. And so they would sprinkle water on someone that wanted to be baptized on their deathbed as an exception. And then it seems like it goes this way with all exceptions. Once there's an exception, it eventually becomes the rule. It's just like infant baptism. It was first the exception, then it became the rule. Well, we'll continue our discussion. I hope this is as fascinating to you as it is to me to try to understand how we got to the place where we are now, when baptism, as it's presented biblically, is such a simple thing. How did we get so far afield? Well, it was small steps. And that leads us away from the simplicity of baptism. Other questions, comments? Yeah, John.
A lot of folks that have their young babies, but most of the time I thought it's more of like they're dedicating a child. Does the Roman Catholic Church have that belief, or is that just a person?
Well, that is a fairly modern understanding, but it's related to viewing baptism as a sacrament. They do it, as you say, as a sign of dedication, which is, again, an addition to the simplicity of baptism as it's presented in the New Testament. But you're right. That's now the reason why, not so much Roman Catholics, but a lot of Protestant churches do that to dedicate their children to the Lord. They want them to grow up in the Lord. Okay. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions, comments? Anybody at home? Well, it's so good to see everybody. We're going to stand in just a minute and we're going to sing a song with James. We will glorify the King of Kings. We will give homage to God. What he's given us is so incredibly simple. It's a shame that we try to make it complicated.